Okay, let me see if I got the levels working on this all right. This will be interview number two, Walter Leroy Malman. This is 5th of May, 1981. I'm gonna try and get into the university a bit today. But I was wondering, first of all, what was it that inspired you as a boy in Escanaba to go to the university? I imagine that'd be pretty unusual for somebody up there at the time.
Well, actually, in high school I had a good time.
Uh-huh.
And I wasn't particularly interested in school. I don't think I ever carried any books home, as I recall. And I probably finished in the upper third of the class, possibly. I don't know where I was, but I would guess probably about the upper third. And after I graduated, my father was in the timber business, mm-hmm. and Land and Timber Company, and I spent most of the summer down on the tennis court or in the lake, and or somewhere in about August. At noon one day, my dad asked me what my plans were for the fall, and I told him I was going to get a job. And of course, it's like most kids, you wouldn't work for your father. You had to work for somebody else. And so I told him that I was going to get a job in the fall. And he informed me that he didn't have an education, and that there was one thing that he was sure of, that I was going to do, and that was go to school. And he said, I don't care where you go. You can go to college or you can go back to high school, but you're not going to have a job this fall. You're going to go to school. So after Dad left, went back to the office, I talked with my mother, and she said, yes, your father is very desirous of you getting an education. And so I told Dad afterward, I said, didn't he send me to a college? I said, only smart people go to college. I'm not one of them. And I said, you're wasting your money sending me to school. But that afternoon I went down and bought a trunk. And in the senior year, there was a fellow named Bill Davidson, who graduated here in 1913, taught in the high school up at Escanaba. And he taught a course in agriculture. And out of curiosity, I took the course. And Bill did a good job, incidentally. He was a pretty good teacher. And as a result of it, I learned about Michigan State. And two or three of the fellows from that class decided to go to Michigan State that year. And so I decided that as long as they were going down there, I'd go too. So I packed up and landed on the campus, scared because I knew I was out of my class. And I had never had any experience with colleges up there. I don't recall in high school ever being told anything about college preparation courses and so forth. So I took whatever I wanted, and my folks never paid any attention to what I was taking, so I just picked up anything I happened to be interested in, I took in high school. But when I landed on campus, I was a scared boy, and my first experience was to stop and ask someone where the administration building was, and the fellow gave me implicit directions, and I found myself down on the Red Cedar River in the woods. And I finally had to wander back and start all over, and I finally got over to the old administration building and registered and bumped into some sophomores that were looking for a room, and we finally tied up, the three of us together, went over to a house over on Albert, right across, well, that first block in Albert Street from the main part of East Lansing now. And I worked my head off that fall term. And every student that I, in the class, I was sure was infinitely better off than I was as far as ability was concerned. And at the end of the quarter, I packed up bag and baggage and got my trunk on the train, went to Chicago, and from Chicago up to Escanaba. And that noon, my father came home from work. The drayman had brought my trunk and put it on the front porch. And Dad came in and wanted to know why I brought my trunk home. And I told him that he'd get a letter from the registrar very shortly, giving him my grades and probably telling him that I couldn't come back. And a few days later, Dad got the letter and came in the house. He said, "It must be a funny college you went to." I said, "Why?" He said, "You got mostly A's." And because I told him I was flunking. So I packed up and came back and stayed the remainder of the time here and took agriculture. I don't know why I took agriculture particularly, except that of course it was given down here, I guess. But as I got into school, I began to be interested in the things I was doing. And I got particularly interested in science. So that the courses in botany and the courses in chemistry and other sciences were extreme interest to me. And I was deciding, each time I took a course, like botany, for example, I decided to major, because that was the thing I wanted. I was going to be a botanist. And in the winter term, I had Woodcock as an instructor. Woodcock came here in the fall of 1914 with a PhD, I believe, from Yale or Harvard. Yale, I guess. And I talked with him about majoring in botany. And then of course, the next year I took, next fall I took bacteriology and entomology in my, that would be in my fall, in fall term 1915. I started taking bacteriology. And I believe in the spring, the previous spring, I got interested in entomology and decided to major in entomology. And I collected grasshoppers for the department in the Upper Peninsula that summer. And when I came back that fall and turned over my collection of stuff to them, I think I had picked up three or four new species of grasshoppers up in the Upper Peninsula that hadn't been identified before. And so I was quite excited about it because I kind of felt that I was in the right field. And then I started taking bacteriology. And when I got into that, I got extremely interested in it. And by the time the spring term came around, I was very, very much interested in it. And I decided pretty much that's what I wanted to be, was a bacteriologist. Well, in the that spring, when I had to register for the following fall, register for the spring term. I had to register for the spring term. I went over to Anderson, who was a class officer for the class, for the sophomore class, and to register. And when I put my stuff down on his desk, he looked at it and I had listed 27 credits. And Anderson was a loud-mouthed individual. And he looked at me and practically shouted and told me that that was the most ridiculous thing he'd ever heard of anyone taking 27 credits. And furthermore, that I was not going to get it. And at that time, I think 20 credits was the normal load. So I assured him that I could do it, that I wanted it. And we got in quite an argument. Then he wanted to know how many credits took the term before. And I don't remember what it was. I think it was about 24 credits, something like that. And then he wanted to know what kind of grades I got. I told him mostly A's, and the rest were B's. And that kind of knocked him down a wee bit. Then he looked at the courses I had, and I had bacteriology and physics and zoology, so on, all science courses. And he informed me that that was not agriculture. And I informed him that it was agriculture, and that I came down to learn the fundamentals behind the field of agriculture, and that I was not interested in learning how to plow so much as I was learning something about soils and how the soils functioned and the composition and so forth of it. And we got in the hang of an argument. And of course, all the students were getting a big kick out of it. They're all sitting there laughing. And he informed me that that was not agriculture. Then he told me that he had a course that spring, and he had a lecture course in Gary, and why didn't I take that? And I was pretty cocky, I guess. And I told him I'd had the course, and he said he didn't recall ever seeing me in class. And I said, no, I didn't take the class. I didn't take it formally, but I had read his book, and I knew that he lectured from the book. And so as far as I was concerned, I had the course. I really was in trouble. And then he said, all right, if you want to take these courses that you got here, he said, you can't take them in agriculture. He said, why don't you go over to home economics, and they let you take anything. And I said, well, if I can go over to home economics and get courses in science, maybe that's what I should do. And of course, all these kids were laughing to beat the cars at this conversation. Well, I was sometimes mad about that thing. I left the ag building, went straight over to the administration building and asked for a transcript of my grades. And I sent them over to the University of Wisconsin and was admitted. And for the next fall term. And of course, at the end of the spring term, I began thinking about the fact of changing schools, and knowing that they had a semester system and we had a tri-semester system. I mean, that they had a semester system, and then they had a tri-semester, we had a tri-semester system, that I would probably lose credit rather than gain. And I kind of had a sneaking hunch that I could finish in 3 years at Michigan State. And I knew if I went to Wisconsin, I'd probably have to go the whole 4 years because of lack of grades, not because of the grades that I would get, so much as the fact that I'd lose on the transfer. So I finally decided to come back that fall, and came back in the fall of 1916. For my junior year, and got over into bacteriology, and got with Zane Northrup, who was a teacher in the department at that time. And Zay was an interesting woman in many respects, and she kind of got me interested in the whole field of bacteriology, and the result was that they let me take a course. I signed up for a course in bacteriology. We only taught three courses at that time, but I signed up for a course, but didn't take the course, but went into research, and wound up with a laboratory in the building for myself, and a key to the building, And I worked, I imagine, practically every night and weekends over in that back building during the fall term, the winter term, and the spring term of that year, doing research on canned tomatoes. And they worked on that on the basis that at that time they were probably processing by hot water, and they weren't getting complete, they weren't getting sterilization and stuff would spoil. And so I isolated the organisms, identified them and so forth that was causing the trouble, and presented the paper before the faculty, and got all A's, of course, out of the darn thing. And really was highly enthusiastic about bacteriology. Well, at the end of the spring term that year, the war broke in April, and practically the whole senior class, as the male members of the class, enlisted, and the university granted them a diploma, in spite of the fact that they were pulled out of here in the middle of the spring quarter. I went over and saw Kedzie, who was acting president at that time, and asked him what I should do. I said, told him that I was a junior, and as far as the time was concerned, but as far as credits were concerned, that I had enough credits to graduate in June, and asked him about what the possible, what I should do. And he told me that as far as if I went, if I enlisted, that I wouldn't get any credit for spring quarter because I was a junior. And suggested that the sensible thing for me to do was to stay in school and graduate. So I stayed. And at the end of the spring quarter, I found that there was a course in animal judging that I hadn't had. And they wouldn't waive it, so I couldn't graduate. And the result was I had to come back in the fall term for a 3-credit course in judging. But that summer I took a job with the group that ultimately became the 4-H club.
Oh yeah.
The what do you call that? They have no name for it. Can't think of it. But anyway, I went up and they were promoting gardens that summer as a war venture, and I took over the town of Escanaba and set up the gardens for the different schools, and then we had competition between the schools to have the best garden and so forth. So I was with the Extension Service, but in the Boys and Girl Clubs work, and I wound up with the second best garden in the state that year, and the hang is his name, I can't think of it. It was head of Boys and Girls Club work. The name slips me right now. Anyway, he was doing the same kind of work up at Marquette, and he had the best gardens in the state, and became the director of the Boys and Girls Club's work the following year, I think. Well, I came back that fall, and a fellow named Linderman was head of that work at that time, offered me a job, full-time job in the Boys and Girls Club work, and I turned it down on the basis that I figured it was a war project. And that fall, I taught school, high school, for a while. I didn't have a diploma, but they took me on up in Escanaba, and I taught high school. I taught for about, as a substitute teacher, for about 3 weeks, I guess. And then the principal came in, wanted me to stay all year, and I was getting $100 a month, and the fellow I had replaced had been getting 125. So I proposed that I would stay at 125, but I wouldn't stay for 100. And he said, well, you don't have a diploma. And I said, well, that's fine. I'll go back to Michigan State and get one. So I came back that fall for 3 credits and completed the course. And in judging, I was irritated at the school for not allowing me to graduate. And in the previous spring. So when I went into this course, I went in with the attitude of not being very cooperative. And I used to go over there into the pavilion ahead of the class because I didn't have anything else to do. And they'd have 4 animals out in the ring sitting there waiting for the class. And I'd look them over, judge them. And then when Brown would come in, who was head of the Department of Animal Husbandry, and George Brown would come in and pass out a slip of paper to each one to fill out. And I would stand there and write my name on the thing and then put the scores down and hand it back to him before the class started, which is a very smart trick, of course. And then I'd go up in the seats and settle down and wait for the class for discussion. And when the discussion would start, first thing George would do would say, all right, Mama, why did you place animal so-and-so as first or second or something like that sort? And I'd get up and tell him. And poor old George never could figure out how I could judge those animals and do it before the class started, even. I don't think he ever figured I came in there early. And he used to sit there and look at that slip. And I invariably used to score those animals the same as he did. I was hitting them on the nose partly, 99% of the time. As a result of it, I got a C. One of the few C's I got while I was a student in school from George. Funny thing about him is that I didn't have much respect for him. I thought he was pretty poor. But later years, I was doing some research on meat, on tenderizing beef. And we had 2 big walk-in refrigerators over in the home ec department, in the old home ec department building. And we had to have... We were hanging halves of beef in these things for study, so we had to have a lot of beef. And George and I used to go down and pick up beef, select the beef. And as a result of working with him, I developed a lot of respect for his ability as a judge. He really was pretty good. I don't think he was very well informed on chemistry and the basic principles of animal husbandry, but he taught in his course in feeds and feedings. I had a lot of disrespect for him because I didn't think he knew much about it, and I still think he didn't know a hang of a lot about feeds and feedings from the standpoint of the science that was back of it. But I did have a lot of respect for him as a judge, and we became very good friends, incidentally, over the years. But I enjoyed just going to college, and that first year that I worked my head off, I learned how to study. And so the following 2 years were relatively easy. I didn't have to work very hard. I worked hard, but I didn't have to. And I used to. When I was in the fraternity house in my junior year.
Which fraternity was that?
It was the Phileans. Uh-huh. They're now the Sigma Chi fraternity. But I used to, at the time of examination, I'd go down to a movie on those nights, and I wouldn't study. And all the rest of these guys were boning their heads off, trying to get prepared for examinations. And I never did any studying at all during this thing. But I got in the habit of, when I came from a lecture, I would just, first chance I had, I would sit down and reorganize my notes, look at the textbooks, and tie up all the things that had been in the lecture very carefully. And I had the stuff in my head. And the result was that I didn't need to. They used to get mad at the fraternity house because I used to always go to shows. Guys would say, "Oh God, you must be taking a pretty soft course. You don't have to study." But that worked out very nicely for me. But I had learned that when I was a freshman, of getting my stuff organized. And I've always followed through on that all my life. When I prepare a lecture, if I were going to a meeting, I would get my stuff organized pretty well before I left. And then the night before, in the hotel, I would sit down and go over that stuff very carefully for maybe half, three-quarters of an hour, and prepare the lecture I was going to give. And then the next morning when I got on the program, I was just something to get up and ad-lib. I didn't need to. I didn't like to read a speech anyway, and I thought it was much more interesting to be able to ad-lib the thing. But I always prepared that lecture the night before, so that it was nice and fresh in my mind when I walked in the next morning to present it. And I found that was a pretty good way of presenting material.
Now, as an agriculture student, were you required to work on the farms at the university?
No. We had no field experience at all. That had disappeared years before. See, originally they used to, way back, they had classes in the mornings, and then in the afternoon the students worked a half day on the farm. That was routine. The interesting thing, if you go back and look at that thing, which I did when I was writing the history of bacteriology for the department, I went back and looked at all the proceedings, board proceedings, from the very beginning, and became very intrigued reading the material, not only from the standpoint of bacteriology, but from the standpoint of the school as a whole. Actually, what they were doing, they were teaching old English and mathematics and the botany and so forth in the mornings, and then the afternoon they practiced agriculture. It wasn't so much of teaching agriculture as it was practicing it. And actually what they were doing was presenting a fairly decent course in basic education, and then an attempt to apply agriculture in the afternoon. So I've often made the statement that the people that came out of here in the early days were probably trained pretty much as they would have been in a private college of humanities and so forth in education rather than in agriculture. And I resented a lot of agricultural courses at that time because of the fact that we would go in the classroom and you'd simply get a listing of agriculture itself. For instance, in farm crops, we would take oats, for example, and the instructor would get up and talk about the oat plant, and then he would talk about the different varieties of oats, and then when you have planted oats, what time of the year you planted them, and the amount per acre that you would plant. And I got, that was the kind of stuff that you got. And I thought that was a waste of time, as far as I was concerned. And we did that in a lot of courses. The laboratory used to consist of, I still remember those courses in farm crops, where they would come in and give you an ear of corn and three or four kernels of corn on the table and a piece of paper. And you drew an ear of corn on a piece of paper, and then you drew a kernel of corn, and you labeled the parts of the kernel of corn. And that was a laboratory. Well, I had had botany, and I had learned about the seed and its structure and so forth. And so I had all this information. And good heavens, I'd seen a ear of corn many times without having to sit there and draw a picture of one. My drawings weren't very good anyway. But that was the laboratory. And I've often thought of what a waste of time that thing was. And that was characteristic of quite a few courses that we took. And so when I was at the University of Chicago, in later years working on my doctor's degree, they were in our class, in our group of graduate students. There was a fellow from Kansas State Agricultural College. There was one from, I think it was Ohio State. And I think there was another one from either Pennsylvania or Illinois. I forgot which one it was. And we would get together at the Commons at lunch and sit down and get talking. And we get talking about the curriculum that we had as an ag student. And boy, did we tear the agricultural colleges apart. We all agreed that the courses that were being taught in all the schools was pathetically bad. And then someone would come in from some of the universities that was graduate student and sit down with us, and we'd be talking. And then this guy would say, well, I always thought that you fellows that went to these land-grant schools never got much of an education. And immediately, all of us would shift and start defending the school that we came from. So it was interesting, and I think that was true of all across the country. That's where the agriculture was being taught at that time. Now, it's a different story.
Sure.
And it's been interesting to watch how those departments have changed over the years. The farm crops and the poultry husbandry and horticulture have changed. Horticulture was pretty good at Michigan State when I was here, and soils was excellent. They were doing an excellent job on soils. But the rest of the courses, I didn't get very excited about them in agriculture.
About how big a school was it back in those days when you were here as an undergraduate?
About 1,500 students.
And it was sort of all confined to what's in the circle area today, is that right? Or was it?
Just the first
north
circle.
North side of the river?
Yeah.
Were there any student traditions? I know you didn't live on campus, apparently. You lived in a house off campus.
No, I had a room over in the Abbott Hall, and I didn't use it. I turned it, I dropped it, stayed off. But I had registered for a room in Abbott.
Uh-huh.
That was you knew where that was, didn't you? Don't you?
Is that the Abbott Hall that's there today yet?
No, Abbott, it was the... is located where the music building is now.
Oh, okay.
And the practice building.
Yeah.
That's just about the location of Abbott Hall. And there's a two-story building. And it would have been that year if I had gone over there. It would have been all juniors in there.
Uh-huh.
And there was no facilities on campus for good living. For instance, if you wanted to take a bath, you had to go to the bathhouse. And of course, that was right alongside of Abbott Hall, so that wasn't too bad. But the Wells Hall, you had to walk and a considerable distance to get over there. But we had a bathhouse, and the showers were in the swimming pool room, along the wall, on the side of the swimming pool. Actually, the water from the showers was practically sprinkling into the swimming pool.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing was true of the house. If you rented a room outside, you had bathroom privileges only for washing your face and hands and shaving and toilet facilities, but no bathing. You had to go over to the, had to take your towel and your fresh underwear and under your arm and walk over to the bathhouse to get a bath. Of course, in those days, you didn't take baths very often, incidentally. Generally, on Saturday, you went over and took a bath. You got a bath about once a week. But that was characteristic. We did that at home. We all took a bath to get ready for Sunday school the next morning. We took a bath on Saturday night.
There must not be too many buildings left from those days. Perhaps those buildings over there by the agriculture building today, maybe some.
Well, see, agriculture building was built in 1910, if I remember correctly. And the dairy building was that building that is now Soils now.
Uh-huh.
I don't know when that was built. I think that was built after the ag building. And then out in front of the ag building was the veterinary building. I stood out on the lawn out there in front of the building. And then there was a road went around the campus, went around the front of the ag building. And then the four or five buildings right following that. So the first one was entomology, the next one was forestry, and then the botany, and bacteriology, and then horticulture. That's those five buildings that are still standing. You ought to keep those buildings. They've been there a long time. And then the next building was Morrill Hall. That was the women's dormitory.
Right.
And then following that building was the terrace. That's, the home economics building is there now. It was a two-story building, a terrace. It was apartments. And I think faculty lived in it. If you're on the faculty, you could get in that building. And then where the union is, in that space right along, as you get to the union building, was Secretary Brown's house, and behind it was Secretary Brown's barn. And then nothing else but woods. And then as you went down where the other side of the Union Building, where the entrance to the campus is, beyond that was the streetcars station and the post office. It was all one building. And then in that space in there, that there was a fenced-in area with three or four deer in it. I don't know if they ever took care of them or not, but there were some deer in there. And I don't know why they had them in there, but they did. And then there was nothing around the rest of it until they got over to Abbott Hall and the Armory. And then nothing again until they got to the engineering building. And the engineering building, and then next to it was an annex where the two-story building where they had the shops. Wood shops were upstairs and metalworking shops were downstairs. And then you came to the powerhouse, and then the ag building. That was it.
So the engineering building would have been around somewhere near where the library is today?
No, the engineering building is just where it is now.
Oh, the Ransom Olds building, right.
Yeah.
I see.
That building burned, but then they reproduced it. They built it exactly the same as it was before.
Right, I forgot.
Yeah, we stood out there in that fire. Those are open stairways. That was an open stairway in that thing. And that those flames went way up in the air. I suppose maybe 50, 60 feet up in the air, the flames are going up through that stairway. And next to it, Wells Hall was next to it, by the way. Wells Hall was the first building, then came the engineering building.
Right.
And they were having the students get out of that building. People were carrying the furniture out and pounding it up. And then there was a kind of a hollow in there where they were pounding the furniture. And then just beyond that was a chemistry building. It sat into the center there. It was a very old building. And the kids had that all piled up with furniture out there from the building. The building caught on fire a couple times, but they were able to put it out. But I had a class at that time in physics in that building. And of course all of our reports and stuff were burned. And the head of the physics department claimed that his PhD thesis was in there and burned. He never got his PhD, incidentally. But he claimed his thesis was in there and burned in the fire. But gee, that was a big fire. We went into the building, the annex building, and were taking out the equipment out of the engine, out of the machine shops. And we got a lot of equipment out. The building was on fire, the fire was upstairs, but we were hauling stuff out of that darn place. And we had a great big milling machine that was broken loose from the floor. And we got it to the door, and the darn thing was about that much wider than the door.
Just a few inches.
So we were deciding to tear the door out, rip it out so we could get that machine out. And then the fireman came over and made us get out of the building because they were afraid that the upper floor was going to collapse. So that thing sat right against the door when the fire was out. But Olds came in and gave them $100,000 to rebuild the building. So they started rebuilding it. Engineering students were put into classes in other buildings. That was in the spring term, if I remember.
What year would that have been again?
That must have been the spring of 1916, I guess.
Uh-huh.
I guess I don't know.
Now, you mentioned...
Oh, yes, then there was another hall. There was Williams Hall was out in the middle there.
Williams.
And then the Agricultural Hall was out in the middle. Where the library sits now. Not the library, but the museum.
Uh-huh.
That's where, that was where the Williams Hall was.
Was Old College Hall still there, where Beaumont Tower is?
Oh, yeah, I had classes in that building. The building was pretty bad shape. As I remember, they didn't allow anybody on the second floor. But they had classes. I took public speaking, I think it was, on the first floor. It was too bad that building went down. There was a lot of argument about the time it happened. They were remodeling the building, and they decided they had to put reinforcements in, so they tore out pretty much the center of the building. And here were these brick walls, one brick thick. And one night the whole thing collapsed. And that was it. There was arguments that at the time that they did it purposely because they wanted to get rid of the darn thing. But I don't think they did. I think they were sincere in wanting to restore it, but they had torn out too much of the building. And it just collapsed. That was a nice building. That wasn't a bad looking building. Three stories, if I remember correctly.
Aside from most of the seniors going off to the war, what other kinds of effects did the war in Europe have on campus?
On what?
On campus, among the students, were students who stayed there instead of going to war considered unpatriotic or anything like that?
No, I don't remember anything of that sort, except that most of the most of the men in the junior class enlisted.
Uh-huh.
And when that class graduated that following year, a year later, it was practically all women. They graduated in the class of 18. And I got my diploma. I really finished classes in 1917, you see, in the fall term, a 3-credit course. And then the Board of Agriculture didn't meet until January. And when they approved the graduation, there were two of us, my roommate and myself. With me from up in the Upper Peninsula, we roomed together. We graduated, the two of us walked into Sec Brown's office. No, it was Fonts, I guess. Yeah, Fonts was the one. We went in to get our diplomas. And Fonts said, well, he said, this is the smallest class we've ever had, so I think I ought to make you a commencement address for the two of us. So we got our diplomas. But I've always listed myself as a class of 18, but I had been with the institution, you see, 9 months before they graduated. There were some things that were funny. For instance, we had to take 3 years of ROTC. All males had to take it, irrespective of who they were or what they were taking. And it consisted of 3 hours of marching. And we met at 5 o'clock, assembled at 5 o'clock, and marched until six. That was ROTC. And then in the winter term, of course, we had class. We had classic. 2 hour class, 2 hours of classwork. That was ROTC, in which we studied regulations and so forth. And everybody cheated 100%. We had these little books, you know, on regulations, and then they'd give an exam on it, and the student would be in charge, senior students were in charge of the class. And everybody get their book out and look up the answers. And so if you didn't do it, you're crazy, because then you get a low grade. So you had to cheat in order to survive. But everybody did. And nobody paid any attention to this stuff. Well, spring term of that year, they changed uniforms when I came here as a freshman. We went to a khaki uniform. Before that, they had a bluish-colored academy-type dress that they wore. And so the seniors and the juniors and the sophomores were wearing these old dress uniforms, more like the academy down at West Point type thing. And the freshmen were dressed in the khaki uniforms that were the same as the service had. So the officers that took over the companies in the freshman group had to buy new uniforms. And also some of the sub-officers, non-commissioned officers, and the result was that they had a shortage on the non-commissioned officers, like sergeants and corporals and so forth. So I wound up the sergeant in my freshman year. I was a sergeant, and the sophomore year I was a sergeant, and then in my junior year. I could, of course, have been an officer, a lieutenant, or a captain. But I decided that inasmuch as I was going to graduate, I hoped to graduate in 3 years, that it was ridiculous to do that because I wouldn't be interested in the fourth year as an officer. So I decided to become a private. And we had a squad of all eight of us were ex-sergeants. It was the first squad in the company. and the whole company, of course, were juniors. And before the war broke, we'd assemble at 5 o'clock. All the companies would be assembled, and then each company would start marching. And this squad, there was one man extra. There was one file closer. It was a sergeant. And we'd head for the woods up at the head of the parade grounds. And poor Fisher would run alongside and holler, a carpenter rather, would holler, "Squad's right, squad's left." Nobody paid any attention to him. We just kept going right straight for the thing. And he'd run up to our squad and he'd say, "Shit, guys, you can't do this. Shit, guys." And we'd go in the woods, put the bayonets on the gun and stick them in the ground and stretch out on the ground in the woods and wait till 6 o'clock. And they were about three companies up there. Three or four companies would be up there in the woods. But we'd all march up in the woods and the officers, of course, they couldn't do anything about it, so they'd sit on the ground to chew the fat up there. And when the war broke, they shoved in a fellow from West Point. They sent an officer in here to take over the ROTC. And as usual, we headed for the woods, and he was out there in the field on the ground. And we went up in the woods as usual, and pretty soon this guy turned up in there. And then string up profanity and get that company's out there on the ground. So we got up and went out and assembled. Then he put us in a great big ring, but I think there were two or three companies, big ring, and then gave us double time. And we trotted about 20 feet and that decided that was enough. So then we started walking, and he was out in the middle giving us hell. And then we finally stopped. Everybody stood there. And he yelled about the fact the war was on and needed to train men, and by God, he was going to train them and so forth. And by God, we were going to do that or pay the penalty. And nobody moved, we just stood there. And so he turned to captains. He said, "Discharge your companies." And he said, "Oh, everybody's flunking." He said, "It's an F for everybody in this class." He said, "You're all through. But we wouldn't have you out here." So we all paraded and took the guns and started running for the armory with the darn things. Dumped them. And about a week later, we got a letter from the administration telling us to come back. He never came out again. But we behaved ourselves from that time on.
Now, as somebody of German extraction, I know that in a lot of parts of the country there was a great feeling of resentment. Did you ever experience any sort of thing like that?
Bauer had a drugstore. There was only one building over on Main Street. Half of it was a restaurant, the other half was a drugstore. And Bauer was a German. And the students decided that he was a anti-America. And they went over there one morning and Bauer gave things away and they practically walked away with that drugstore. They just marched in and took every damn thing they wanted. The old man never tried to stop them. But outside of that, I don't know of anything. My father dropped the N off of his name because he felt that N indicated that he was a German. And by taking the N off, he wasn't, I guess. But I didn't. I decided that, by God, my ancestors ran back to long before the Revolution. And because I had an extra N in my name, by God, it didn't make a difference. They're going to keep it. I was half German, half English. But my ancestors came over here about 1710, something like that. Hmm. And they're located in Lancaster County up in Pennsylvania. But there was a lot of stuff. There's a lot of anti-German feeling. For instance, German fried potatoes, which they changed the name of them to American fried, I guess I'm not to call them. And German foods were out. But that didn't happen in the Second World War. There wasn't any. That kind of thing didn't happen at all. But that first one, there was a lot of feelings for Germans. We used to sit in the fraternity house long before the war broke for us. And one night I'd be defending the Kaiser. The next night I'd be against him. And we had a couple Germans in there. Retzlaff, Dutch Retzlaff, who was very, very strong in feeling toward the war. I mean, we weren't in it, of course, but he was very strongly for the Germans. And so about half the time, Retz and I would be on the opposite sides. I'd be damning the Germans, he'd be praising them. But I never had any particular feeling for or against the darn thing, except that when the war broke here, there wasn't any question in my mind that something had to be done. And I tried to enlist. I went all the way to Chicago to get in the Navy and got turned down. And then later I tried to get into the Army and didn't get turned down. They claimed that I arrived too late to enlist. And then I got into the draft and was put in limited service on the basis of an inguinal rupture, which I do have. But I was so concerned about it. I was married at that time. And I immediately took a train all the way up to Escanaba to see our local doctor, who I had great faith in, and told him that that the doctors had said I had an inguinal rupture. And I said I wanted it repaired, and I came up there and I wanted him to do the operation. He examined me and he said, well, if you have an inguinal rupture, then 99% of the people I've examined have inguinal ruptures. He said, I don't think you have it at all. I did have it. And later years, I found out that I did. It never bothered me. It's never bothered me at all. But the inguinal ring was enlarged. And so there would be the possibility of the intestines slipping through the ring. Then you get strangulation of the thing and, of course, infection. And in those days, you'd probably die because there was no way of handling that sort of thing.
Was there a lot of domestic war effort sort of activities at that time, different programs and things in support of the war effort?
Oh yeah, yeah. That was feeling was very strong. And for instance, I had trouble with my board because it's up in Escanaba, and I couldn't get any contact with them. I write them letters, and I never get an answer from them. And everybody gone down and been examined for the draft. I never got an order for it. Never did get one. And I went down to draft board in Lansing and told them the situation. And so I had written to them repeatedly and I never got any answer from them. I never got any announcement. And I said, everybody's been, that I know, has been down and taken an examination. And I said, I've never had one. And I said, why don't you examine me? Well, you got to be examined by your local board. They said, if they would tell us to do it, we'd do it. Well, we argued for a while, and finally they said, okay, it's not according to the rule, but we'll give you an examination. So they gave me an examination, and two doctors examined me, and both of them claimed I had an inguinal rupture. And then we had this crazy thing of weight, and I only weighed 123 pounds, and I think I was supposed to weigh 146 or 156 pounds, and so that was charged against me. And the Navy turned me down cold on. They just hung weight. And I went in to enlist. I walked in the office in Chicago and told them I wanted to enlist in the Navy. And the guy said, no, you don't. You don't want to enlist in the Navy. And I said, yes, I do. He said, well, we wouldn't take it. And I said, why not? And he said, don't weigh enough. He said, you got to weigh 146 or 156. I forgot which it was. And I never even took off my coat. And he said, how much do you weigh? And I said, about 123, 25 pounds. Well, I said, you can't get in the Navy. Too lightweight. But this was also one reason why I didn't get into the draft. So I was in limited service. Well, I had a draft card then. I finally got a draft card. And then I was sent down to Toledo by the Extension Service to have charge of a shipping department of seed corn for the corn states. And I no sooner got down, I don't think I'd been down there a day until a fellow came in and wanted to see my draft card. And I took out my wallet and I didn't have it. And I said, oh Lord, I said, I left on without even going to the house, because I said I was ordered down here immediately. So I caught the train, my wife brought me a bag from give me a to go on the train. I said, then she's coming down later on. And I said, she'll probably have the draft card, because I probably left it at home. Well, he was kind of worried about it. He said, you'll have to have a draft card. And I said, sure, I've got one. She came down and didn't have it. And I went through the entire war without a draft card. I wrote letters to that draft board up there. I knew the fellow, Dr. Cotton, was head of the draft up in Escanaba. And I wrote him several letters. And he wrote back and told that they had orders from Washington not to issue the cards, replacement cards, because the fellows were selling them. And so they wouldn't give me a draft card. So I carried these letters in my pocket in case I got picked up. Instead of showing the draft card, I showed them the letters that I had correspondence with the draft board, telling them that they wouldn't give me another draft card because people were selling them. And but I never got caught. We came out of a theater one time down in Lansing, and just across the street when a bunch of police pulled up and started checking everybody for draft cards coming out of the theater. And another time when I was in Toledo, we were coming back to Lansing. They were there were officers at every step on the train, checking everybody getting on the train for draft cards. And I told my wife, I said, "Well, this is where we're going to get settled, get this thing straightened out." And I said, because I said I'm going to walk up there and I don't have a draft card. So I said, chances are that I'll be taken to the police station. And I said, the thing for you to do is get on the train, go to Lansing. And I said, you know, I'll have to get in contact with the draft board in Escanaba and get clearance on it. But I said, maybe this is a good thing, because I'll get this thing cleared up. And just as I walked up, someone called this guy. And he turned around and I walked down the train. So I never got caught. I used to talk about the fact that I was a draft dodger during the war. And then about a year afterward, I went to the, and check our safety deposit box. And I got an insurance policy out and I'll drop the card. Somehow I got stuck into the insurance policy. So then I carried that darn thing for about 4 or 5 years, just on general principle. But they had quite a lot of trouble with that sort of thing. And there wasn't any protests like we had.
Sure.
But the individuals would not be drafted, and then they'd pick them up. They'd catch them every once in a while. They were pretty rough on them. They didn't pull the monkey business. When you got caught, you were in trouble.
Well, we've been at it almost an hour now. Would you like to call it off?
Yeah. No, just as you say. Go further if you want to.
I was just wondering if you have any particular memories of any of the campus traditions, or was there any appropriate behavior or inappropriate behavior for an undergraduate back in those days? I know that.
Well, after the war was over, and the boys came back, they were an unruly bunch. Gee, they were rough. And they came back, and about in the spring term that year, but seemed about every week. I don't think it was that often, but it was pretty close to it. They would have what they called a Bolshevik day, and they had a piece of canvas from here with the window along, that something said Bolshevik Day on it. And they would tie that up in the trees right across from the street from the smoke shop, which was across the street. And they put that sign up, Bolshevik Day. Generally was on a Friday. Not always, sometimes other days. And then some of the band boys would get out in the circle, start playing, and then they start marching around the circle of the campus. And as they moved along, they finally wind up with a pretty good sized band. Guys would run out with their instruments and assemble. And then they'd go to the different classrooms, and no classes today, Bolshevik Day. And they'd empty all the classrooms out. Then they'd go over to the armory and get a orchestra together, and they'd have a dance in the afternoon. That thing happened repeatedly during the spring quarter. One day I was coming to work, and that sign was out there, and Dr. Bessie went across the street, took a jackknife out of his pocket, cut the sign down, rolled it up, put it under his arm, and started walking over by the home ec building, and four or five students ran out from the smoke shop, ran across the street, and snagged him. Here's little Dr. Bessie hanging on the sign, pulling on the sign, and they finally took it away from him and put it back up. But the administration didn't seem to be able to control the thing at all. The thing went on. They came to our building one time, and Giltner came out, and Giltner said, "They're not coming in this building." And I said, "Well," I said, I think you're being foolish. I wouldn't fight it." I said, "You got a fight on your hands." And he walked down there and stood in the doorway. And for some ungodly reason, they went by the building. I don't know why. I expected them to toss him in the ditch or something, but they didn't come in the building.
You're mentioning Bolshevik Day. Did the Russian Revolution have much impact on the campus here? Was there much concern over that?
I don't remember any. I don't remember any at all. Hmm. Other than the fact that they knew what was going on.
Sure.
But when these kids came back, I had a rough time. I had to set up a course for engineers in bacteriology, sanitary engineers. And this meant that the whole civil engineering class had to take this course. And at that time, the Department of Bacteriology was in the School of Agriculture. And these kids were raising hob over in the engineering school with instructors. And one of the kids that was a Philean came over to see me, and he said, "You're going to have trouble with the engineers." He He said they're all talking about the fact that they're going to have to take a damned ag course, because the course is in the agriculture department. And he said they're coming over here with to just rip the hell out of everything. And he said, I just thought I'd tell you. Well, that morning when they came in, I went downstairs to go to the class, and my God, there was a bedlam in the classroom. And Giltner had a sign up on the board that said, examine your seats before you sit down. And if there's anything wrong with it, report it to the instructor. Otherwise, you'll be charged with the damage to the seat. And the seats had wooden backs on them, and they were put into a metal frame, and they were loose. You shake them. But this piece of wood is about like that, and the back of the seat. And these kids were shaking these pieces of wood in these seats, because it's that sign up there told them to examine their seat, and they were examining them. And I waited, and I figured that they'd get tired after a while. And finally they quit. And I was then about 10 minutes after the hour, and I hadn't walked in the classroom yet. I stood outside the door waiting, and they finally stopped. And then I walked in. When I walked in, here were these fellows, these backs on the seats were kind of high, and everybody had his feet up on the seat like this. So I was looking at a bunch of feet, and everybody had their hats on. And I took a look at them, and I figured that if I were to tell them to take their feet down and take off their hats, I was in trouble. So I thought, well, maybe if I start lecturing, I can get them to, because it'd be uncomfortable the way they were sitting there. I thought maybe they'd settle down. So I started talking, and got lecturing and started talking about bacteria, and kept right on as though it was just a normal class. And gradually, one by one, they took their feet off the thing. By the end of the hour, they were sitting with their hats on, but they had their feet off the front of the seats. The next period, and they came in, we went through another period of shaking seats, and I waited again for about 10 minutes. And I walked in, and this time all they did was they were sitting there with their hats on. And I lectured to a bunch of hats that day. The third time I went in, they were shaking the seats again for about 10 minutes. And when I walked in, they had their hats off. And that wound up to be an excellent class. And that those kids didn't skip any periods from that thing, and they were skipping over in the engineering school to meet the devil. And I got them interested. And they had a laboratory, and those kids would come over extra hours and come in there and work in the laboratory. They were that interested. And then I had one fellow in there. I'll never forget that fellow. He came from Trout Creek up in the Upper Peninsula. And he played a mandolin, and also sang a lot of dirty songs. And he was quite popular on campus. Every time they'd have a meeting or something, they'd have to get him up, and he'd perform. And I was talking about bacteria, and I was pointing out the fact that when the life originated on this earth of ours, it probably was a single cell that has organized and began to function. And so that the single-celled organisms were probably the original things that occurred on the face of the earth. And I said, of course, from a biblical standpoint, I said, you can take this thing from the standpoint of evolution if you want to, or you can think of the fact that man became out of the animal group, became a man in the sense of being able to think and reason and have a brain that of quality, that that was the beginning of man. I said, you make your own decision on that, but I said, if we look at it from the standpoint of evolution, the bacteria are probably the first things on the earth. And the next day, this guy came up to my office, and he walked in, and he said, do you believe in the goddamn Bible? And I said, yes. yes, I believe in the Bible. And he says, well, I believe in the goddamn thing. And he said, my church doesn't recognize the stuff that you're talking about. And I said, well, I pointed out to you that you can have different viewpoints of what consists of the creation of the earth. And I said, you have to remember that those people were pretty primitive at that time. They didn't have the information we had. And I said, a lot of the things in the Bible that we can account for were perfectly normal things that happened, but they were very important things to those people at that time. And I said, from the standpoint of religion, I said, yes, I accept these things. They mean something to me. I think that although their origin may be obscure, it still makes sense. And here was this conversation, this fellow sitting there with about two-thirds profanity discussing the Bible. You know, I'll never forget that thing. Funny part was that fellow graduated from here, and in a short time he was the manager of a utility out, I think, in Kansas City. Became quite successful. I often wonder if he still could swear like he did.
Well, I think